I'd like to introduce you all to this installment of our CMRS lecture series on feast and famine in the Middle Ages and Renaissance. And we've already had some remarkable presentations in this series, and this one will no doubt rise to the level, if not above it, because we're going to hear from Professor Timothy McGee from the University of Toronto. And thinking about Tim McGee's identity, it's hard to find the right words. Quietly heroic is something that springs to mind. Here's a person who has had a long and illustrious career of piercing the bubbles of pretension and false reasoning, and with a strong musical background as a performer, and a very sharp critical eye and seriousness about a wide range of sources, beginning with musical notation and the manuscript as a full-fledged historical artifact, but reaching to other forms of information as well, including visual information, theoretical information, and then subjecting them to the broader environment that surely conditioned all music making, which is that of performance. And here's one of the signal figures in late 20th century musicology confronting the issue of performance practice and what we now call performance studies. So Tim McGee has done pioneering work in areas that people would have said, oh yeah, that's been done. But once you see his work, you realize, no, it actually has not been done. He sets the tone for future studies in the nature of song, the nature of dance, instrumental dancing, and here, ceremonial music, where he's had a project which I think he's been working on for a long time, but which has borne fruit in a number of articles and now in this book, on the ceremonial musicians of Florence. Fascinating topic that deals with just the full life of the city from a point of view that might be somewhat unsuspected for many. And I think in this way, Tim McGee enters the field of medieval studies and Renaissance studies from that peculiar doorway we refer to as music. And, you know, as the new director of the CMRS and as a musician, I see the chasms that surround us in all fields, but particularly in music, since music is seen as somewhat of a recondite field by some folks that are not in that field. But I think Tim McGee makes that wonderful transition between textual sources, musical notated sources, and other kinds of information that try to give us a sense of the fuller identity of performing and living musically in the Middle Ages and Renaissance. Now, Professor McGee is so associated with the University of Toronto that I was surprised to learn a few minutes ago that he's actually from New York. But he went to graduate school at the University of Pittsburgh after teaching music, got an interest in scholarship, and wrote a dissertation on the Quem Quaeritis dialogue, and then got a job at Toronto in 1971, where he's taught ever since. And let me just name a couple of his books. He's written many articles in many, many prestigious journals, but here are some of the books that he's written. The Music of Canada, 1985, another thing that made me think, this guy's a deep Canadian. Medieval and Renaissance Music, A Performer's Guide, one of the very first books to take on the topic of performance from the broadest point of view, bringing all types of information to bear on performance practice. Medieval Instrumental Dances of 1989, an edition of all 47 known instrumental dances and a full discussion of theory, notation, and context for medieval instrumental dances. The edited book with A.G. Rigg and David Klausner on singing early music, the pronunciation of European languages in the late Middle Ages and Renaissance, which takes advantage of modern study of many different languages, including many varieties of Italian, Latin, as spoken in different countries, to try to start to get a sense of how language sounded in performance. Once again, music as an entire lived experience that draws upon so many different cultural elements. Then another wonderful book from 1998, The Sound of Medieval Song, Ornamentation and Vocal Style According to the Treatises. Something that you think, okay, well, that's obvious. Is it obvious? Not at all. And in fact, nobody had ever studied this with anywhere near the depth or rigor that Professor McGee brought to it. And then his Ceremonial Musicians of Late Medieval Florence from 2009, which serves as the backdrop to the present talk. So please, a warm welcome to Professor Tim McGee, Emeritus of Toronto.
I'm not sure I can live up to that. Anyway, I'll try. my contribution to the feast and famine theme of this year's lecture series concerns the situation in the city of Florence following the time of Lorenzo de' Medici in the last decade of the 15th century, when the traditional celebratory and artistic traditions were abruptly broken and adjusted by the preacher Girolamo Savonarola. There were repercussions in almost every aspect of life in the city, but I'll single out the effect on the public ceremonies, the musical traditions, and the fine arts, and how the artistic community reacted. First, let me remind you a bit about the city we're going to discuss, which even at that time was considered the jewel of Europe. Here's this city from a contemporary map. Prominent in the center of the city is the Duomo, the cathedral, these places I'll be talking about in the lecture. And in front of it is the city building. The large spire there is the city building, the Palazzo della Signoria. Here's another map from almost the same time as supposedly seen from above. Again, you'll see the Duomo bottom center, and right above it, the Palazzo della Signoria. Gives you some idea of where things are in relationship to one another. And then, of course, the river that divides the city in half. Here's a contemporary photo, shows you exactly the same things. The same two buildings still dominate. There's the city building itself, and the palazzo that plays an important part in the lecture. One of the colorful bridges, this is the Ponte Vecchio with the shops on it, mostly gold now. And another picture, this is a little closer to the date we're talking about, showing a couple of the bridges. During the centuries, the late Middle Ages and Renaissance, Florence did everything with real style. They especially knew how to celebrate. Each year, there were celebrations of one kind or another on more than 200 days. Now, I'm not talking about small things. I'm talking about big public celebrations that were open to the entire population. Many of them were annual celebrations tied to either the church calendar or the seasonal calendar. Some of the obvious ones that many cities still celebrate: Christmas, Easter, Carnival. But then Florence added the 1st of May, the Feast of St. John in June, the name day of each of the churches, and there were 56 churches. And then there was the appointment of a new executive committee for the government. That happened every 2 months. Then the unscheduled events, celebration of a military victory, the knighting of a distinguished nobleman, the visit of an important person, and lots of important people visited Florence. Almost everything could be considered a good occasion for a public ceremony, and everything was celebrated in style with processions, floats, games, wild animal shows, races, mock battles on the river, masquerades, jousts, dramatic productions, and dancing in the streets. And in order to bring the proper amount of pomp to these celebrations, the city of Florence employed 28 full-time musicians who helped make all of the celebrations really special. With a population of only 50,000 people, nearly everyone in Florence would have had to spend a very large share of their time preparing and participating in the ceremonies. And in fact, a Florentine merchant by the name of Gregorio Dotti wrote a description of the preparations for the Feast of St. John that suggests exactly that. This is what Gregorio wrote. When spring arrives, all the world rejoices, and every Florentine begins to think of participating in the beautiful Feast of St. John. 2 months before the festa, preparations are begun for the horse race, the costumes of the attendants, the flags and the trumpets, the banners from the nearby cities that give its tribute, the candles, the other things that must be offered, the people to invite, things to purchase for the wedding celebrations, the horses that come from everywhere to run the race. And they show happiness and a spirit full of joy on the feast days preceding that of St. John, such as St. Zenobius, the Ascension, the Feast of Pentecost, the Blessed Trinity, and the Feast of Corpus Christi. They dance, play, and sing, take part in banquets and jousts and other traditional games, so that it appears that no one has anything else to do prior to the vigil of St. John. Now, you'll notice that although what the writer was describing were all sacred occasions, most of what he was talking about with the events were all secular. And that's the sort of thing we will see all through this, the mixture of sacred and secular, so that they're actually inseparable. And that's one of the things that really irritated Savonarola. Let me give you an idea of the different kinds of events that took place. First, processions. All processions were led by the civic trumpeters and drummers. There were several different official processional routes depending on the nature of the event, but most of them involved both a major cathedral, the Duomo, and an official event that would happen in the piazza in front of the Palazzo della Signoria. This is a scene from a later century, but the idea of the size is the same as the earlier centuries. If the occasion was religious, a saint's day, or a visit of a pope, the procession would include all the priests and the choirs from the many churches, assembled behind banners that represented each church. Then there were the societies of laymen. These groups were very popular, and each church had a hymn society that included dozens and dozens of men, each group following behind its banner. Everyone in the procession would carry a candle and sing as they moved through the streets of the city. If the event was not religious, instead of church groups, the procession would have been full of members of the trade guilds, who would carry banners and wear costumes that associated them with their guild. The most important were the wool workers, the leather workers, the dyers, and the healthcare workers. And at the end of whatever was the celebration, there would always be dancing in the streets. Then there were the floats. These were a bit different from modern floats because they circulated as a separate parade. They were highly decorated carts with costumed people and drawn by sets of oxen. Each cart would stop when it arrived at a piazza, and there are dozens of piazzas around the city. Then the people on the cart got off and put on a short dramatic show. And then they went on, back on the cart, and went on to the next piazza. Some of these float parades would include as many as 45 carts, meaning that the show they put on at each piazza would last for hours. But processions were just the beginning of every celebration. In addition, a number of other events would normally be presented as well. I'll tell you just some of the more spectacular ones. A horse race called a palio, which consisted of 9 riders riding bareback, no saddles. The race began at the city wall on the west, went through the narrow, twisting streets right through the central market and over to the wall on the east side. If the rider fell off, which usually happened, the horse could still win. The winner received a banner, which is called a palio. Then there were jousts. This is a French joust. Jousts took place in the piazza in front of the Church of Santa Croce, and that's what this scene is. Stands were set up for the spectators, with the most prominent citizens watching from the balconies. The contestants, and they were usually 10 or 12, were dressed in armor and tried to knock one another off their horses. There was very often quite serious consequences, since the lances they had sometimes caused serious injury to the men or the horses. The winner was given a silver helmet and a banner. And our armeggeria is another type of military game where knights on horseback compete for prizes. This is a little different. This is one from the time of Lorenzo. This is a little later. And this is a modern reenactment. What happens is that the Saracen that they're trying to kill is a dummy that's hinged two ways. If the rider and his staff hit the dummy dead center, it falls over and he wins. If he doesn't and hits it to either side, the arm that's sticking out in the Middle Ages would have a chain and a lead weight on the end, and it would swing around and wrap him in the head. You see that in the modern recreation, they're far more merciful. There's nothing on the end of that arm. At all of the festivals, there were also games for the younger set. These typically featured young men in their 20s, but also young boys got involved with their own kinds of events. The most popular was fighting with one another and throwing stones. They would divide into two groups on opposite sides of the river, with hundreds of boys in each group. And then they would advance on one another over the bridges, punching one another out, and then hurling rocks. Lots of boys got very seriously hurt each time, and the city kept passing laws that it was forbidden, but they did it anyway. Another of the games was called Stiles. Several young unmarried men would set up a barricade, a stile, across a city street and require the passersby to pay a small toll. Believe it or not, this was considered a great way to meet unmarried girls, who otherwise had very little contact with the unmarried men. Another favorite event for the Florentines was a caccia, a hunt. What they did was fence off a portion of the main piazza in front of the Palazzo della Signoria, and then they put in various animals into the enclosure, usually bears and bulls, but sometimes cows, and one time even a giraffe. And then they sent in the city lions. There were 16 lions that were kept permanently in the city because one of the symbols of the city is Marzocco, the city lion. There was scaffolding erected around the outside of the enclosure where the citizens could stand and watch the animals fight one another to the death. Always the lions won, Florence. As Gregorio Dati told us, the most important celebration of the year was on the 24th of June, the feast of St. John the Baptist. The citizens considered the feast of their patron saint to be identical with the image of the city itself. So to celebrate St. John was to celebrate Florence. It was the one ceremony of the year that was officially both religious and secular. So not only were all the churches represented, but also all of the guilds. There were 2 days of minor processions all around the city, and processions of dozens of floats with dramatic scenes that played in each of the piazzas. And then on the day before the feast itself, there were the most elaborate of all processions, led by all the civic musicians, with all the priests from all the churches dressed in their most splendid vestments and with all of their relics held under canopies. Then the choirs, the lay societies, the knights, the guilds, the military associations, fireworks shooting off from the towers of all of the churches. On the next day, the actual feast of St. John, the major event was a palio with horses racing through the streets. And then everyone went back to their own area of the city for banquets that took place in the streets, and then the public dances in all of the piazzas that went on until dawn. We know that throughout this time, music was a very important part of civic life in Florence. It was everywhere. There was sacred music during the church services. Every one of the ceremonies that took place in the city involved music. There was music in the private homes of the elite citizens, performed by highly trained singers and instrumentalists. The ceremonial trumpet and shawm players played mostly fanfares and dance music. But there was a very large quantity of other types of music all over the city. From quite early in the century, Florence imported composers and singers from France and the Netherlands, who brought with them the new sophisticated polyphonic music, which was added to the substantial Italian repertory already in place. Some of the finest composers and performers worked for the Florence Cathedral, the Baptistry, and the Church of Santa Nunziata. The cathedral records show that in 1490, that choir consisted of 18 members, including a half dozen of the most distinguished composers from the north. In their official roles, of course, they composed and sang sacred music, but they were capable of secular music as well, and they wrote and performed this in both public and private. The Medici family had an interesting way of mixing public and private interests as far as the musicians were concerned. They had their agents on the lookout all over Europe to recommend highly skilled instrument players, composers, and singers. Then they used their influence to have the instrumental musicians appointed to the civic band, and the composers and singers appointed to the church choirs. The duties of these musicians always included the obligation to perform for the Medici, both at their frequent banquets in their palaces or to accompany them when they visited other courts. These musicians were also available for hire by other noble families for their private use, but the records show that the Medici had first call and didn't have to pay. Art flourished as well in the late 15th century. Paintings and sculptures were in abundance, but unlike the music scene, there was no need to import painters from other countries in order to have the finest and most up-to-date quality. Much of it was homegrown, or very nearly homegrown. Ghirlandaio, Donatello, Botticelli, Filippino Lippi, Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, Cosimo Rosselli, Perugino. They were either from Florence or worked a long time in Florence. They found employment in the churches, where they painted sacred frescoes and panels, and in the private palaces of the elite, where they decorated the chapels with sacred scenes and honored the patrons with portraits and frescoes of secular scenes. Here's a painting by Botticelli depicting the Medici family. The scene actually pretends to be a religious one. It's the adoration of the Magi. But in place of the usual Magi, all the men are portraits of the members of the Medici family. So this is both sacred and secular at the same time, which is one of the things I wanted to emphasize. So many of the ceremonial things in Florence had both those elements. Here's another of Botticelli's famous paintings, The Birth of Venus. This one, of course, is completely secular. To assist with artistic growth, Leonardo the Magnificent sponsored a studio where a number of up-and-coming artists could work. He was especially generous to Michelangelo, who was given an apartment in the Medici Palace when he was young. So as you can see, the cultural scene in Florence, both public and private, was full, busy, and of extraordinary quality, until Girolamo Savonarola came to town. The Dominican friar first arrived in the city in 1482 for a very short period, but he must have impressed Lorenzo de' Medici, who invited him back in 1490. Savonarola was a mesmerizing speaker who captured an enormous following of citizens in his campaign against the secularization of religious practices, the immoral behavior of citizens and clergy, and the widening gap between the rich and the poor. Now, those sound like legitimate concerns, but as with most things, the devil is in the details of how you define the objectives and to what degree the goals are pursued. During the time of Lorenzo, Savonarola didn't directly attack the wealthy elite class. But when Lorenzo died in 1492, Savonarola seized the opportunity to widen his reference. Lorenzo's son and successor, Piero, proved to be an ineffectual leader who aroused severe criticism from the other elite Florentine families who had previously supported the Medici. And in 1494, Piero and the rest of the family were all expelled from Florence, leaving the city without the influence of the powerful Medici family that had guided it for the previous 60 years, and tipping the balance of social power and influence in the direction of the radical friar. Savonarola's ire was directed towards anything and everything secular, including art, music, and public ceremonies. He was especially focused on the yearly celebration of Carnival, which was traditionally a time of excessive behavior in anticipation of the coming penitential time of Lent. But in fact, he zeroed in on virtually every part of life, not only public behavior, but personal and private behavior. A central tenet was that Florentines should return to the simplicity of life, abandon excess pomp and ceremony in their worship services, as well as any extravagant display in daily life. He urged them to abandon any activity or interest that was not centered on simple religious worship. Savonarola promised the citizens that if they followed God's work of reform, Florence would become the new Jerusalem, and they would enjoy great wealth, both in the present life and in the hereafter. To be specific, he demanded that all public as well as private celebrations contain only religious elements. Music would be confined to simple hymn singing, like the songs called Laude. Artists would no longer represent secular scenes. They would devote their time only to the creation of religious art. And secular literature would be shunned in favor of religious readings. He encouraged his followers not only to abandon all of their former secular practices, but to destroy all objects that were contrary to the simple honor of God. He criticized the members of the clergy and urged them to turn away from their ignorant and venal ways, and all of the convents and mission and monasteries were to return to the life of strict fasting and prayer. By garnering enormous popular support, he was able to pressure the civic government into turning most of these reforms into laws. And Savonarola organized thousands of youths who would go door to door in the city, encouraging the citizens to dispose of the art that was not sacred, and reporting on those who didn't comply. The result was that virtually all public ceremonies were now turned into religious events, and those that could not were eliminated. Visitors to the city were welcomed with processions that included the civic musicians, but the other events that had traditionally accompanied such welcomes were eliminated and replaced with visits to church. The Civic Security Commission even banned all public gatherings on the two big civic feasts of Carnival and the Feast of St. John. The palio races were stopped. Public dancing, a standard event in conjunction with all ceremonies, canceled. A part of Savonarola's genius was to hijack the major feasts and change each of their component parts into religious observations. All elements of Carnival, for example, were changed into sacred events. The number of sacred processions was increased, and they involved only visits to church. In the procession, each of the youth groups, called the fanciulli, formed behind religious symbols representing their particular group, a crucifix or an image of the Virgin, and went through the streets singing hymns. Instead of throwing stones, the younger boys begged for alms for the poor. And instead of the game of styles, the older boys stood on street corners holding crucifixes. By Lent of 1497, Savonarola's powers had grown to the point where he could launch his most dramatic public attack in the form of the first of two bonfires of the vanities. First of all, the youth groups, the fanciulli, carried out house-to-house searches for worldly items to consign to the bonfire. This met with weak opposition. Savonarola's opponents pointed out that now the city was governed by children, and they feared Florence had become the laughingstock of Christendom. But these few contrary voices held no sway, and the bonfire went ahead. It consisted of an enormous wooden pyramid erected in the middle of the Piazza della Signoria, with an image of Satan on the top and devils all around the bottom. Here's a contemporary account, a description of the pyramid itself. Each of its eight sides had 15 shelves on which were placed all the accursed stuff of Carnival, shameful pictures and sculptures, gambling devices, musical instruments and music books, masks, costly foreign draperies with immodest scenes, sculptures of very beautiful and shapely ancient Roman and Florentine women by Donatello and other great masters, gaming boards, playing cards, dice, all the women's vanities, hairpieces, headbands, cosmetic cases, polish, mirrors, perfumes, face powder, musk, wigs. Other shelves held all the lascivious Latin and vernacular books, including Luigi Pulci's Morgante, works by Petrarch, Dante, and even Boccaccio's Decamera. Still other shelves held beards, masks, wigs, and every diabolic instrument in use. As the fire consumed all of these objects, some of which were irreplaceable works of art. A large number of Savonarola's followers, including the thousands from the youth groups, stood around the piazza, and with the civic trumpets sounding and the church bells tolling, they chanted the Te Deum Laudamus. And following the bonfire, the procession continued to the cathedral, where they sang many more laude. Even the high-quality sacred music was the subject of Savonarola's reforms. He put an end to the sophisticated, elaborate masses and motets composed by the Northerners, declaring that it does nothing but charm the ear and the senses. He outlawed organ playing in church, which he claimed distracted the faithful from their worship. As a result, organs remained silent. The choirs in the three main churches was disbanded, and the singing of anything but the simplest syllabic music was abandoned in all churches, monasteries, and convents. The high-quality northern musicians left town to find employment in places such as Innsbruck, Venice, Ferrara, and Rome, never to return. The performance of secular music in the palaces of the elite citizens also was severely curtailed. They stopped hiring the professional musicians for their private parties in fear of invoking Savonarola's wrath and receiving a public scolding. Although we know that there were hundreds of carnival songs and manuscripts during that time, only a single sheet survives from before the death of the monk. There's no doubt that dozens and dozens of collections of secular music were destroyed in public displays such as the burning of the vanities. Religious painting continued to flourish, but all secular painting came to a halt. But even though there were still commissions for sacred art, the atmosphere was so tainted against art in general that some artists felt quite uncomfortable. Leonardo da Vinci left for Milan. Michelangelo left for Venice. Perugino went back to Perugia. The rest of the painters stayed in town and concentrated on sacred scenes. The austere times, fortunately, didn't last. Savonarola's extreme views included attacks on the church hierarchy in general, and the Pope in particular, which made him extremely unpopular in Rome. He had predicted that Rome would be singled out above all for God's scourging wrath. In June of 1497, Pope Alexander VI, that's Rodrigo Borgia, excommunicated him and forbade him to preach, but he defied the order. Rome also threatened to interdict the city of Florence, which meant that they would be forbidden to conduct any religious ceremonies. They also threatened economic reprisals against the Florentine banks, and that caused a number of the influential citizens to question their support for the friar. In April of 1498, shortly after the second burning of the vanities, everything came to an abrupt halt as Savonarola and two of his Dominican associates were arrested and taken to the Palazzo della Signoria for questioning. Following an examination that included torture and the breaking of a few bones, Savonarola admitted to being a false prophet. Further questioning by papal emissaries resulted in his condemnation as a heretic and schismatic. On the 23rd of May, all three Dominican friars were hanged and their bodies burned on a pyre in the same place where earlier the vanities had been burned, putting an end to 8 years of intense artistic suppression. As I pointed out, Savonarola's ability to intimidate and bully the citizens into accepting his reforms was enormous. And in fact, his influence continued on some levels for the next 50 years, both in Italy and elsewhere in Europe, where his preachings were respected and promulgated by reform-minded clerics. But although most of the Florentines had gone along with the reforms, not everybody believed. The amount of pent-up fury on the part of a significant portion of the citizens can be seen in the fact that once Savonarola was silenced, much of what he suppressed returned, and some of it rather quickly. 3 days after he was arrested, the chapel choir at the cathedral began to sing sophisticated polyphony once again. And of course, along with the reinstated sacred music, came an abundance of secular music to be performed in public and at the renewed banquets of the elite citizens, as well as public dancing in the piazzas. The civic government, the Signoria, resumed the commissioning of public artist monuments, and Michelangelo returned to Florence to begin work on his most famous work, the David. Leonardo also returned, and both he and Michelangelo received commissions from the government to paint enormous murals on the walls of the city buildings. Once Savonarola was gone, all the major festivities changed back to their traditional forms. After 8 years of religious oppression, the citizens of Florence were more than ready to return to their old secular ways. Already in 1499, the stone throwing had returned to carnival time. Horse races, naval battles, parades of floats all returned as if nothing had happened, and public dances, once again, ended every festivity. To have such a strong backlash against the reforms so quickly after Savonarola was put to death suggests that there must have been an enormous amount of resentment building up throughout the years of his reign. Even before Savonarola's dramatic end, there were signs that he was beginning to lose some of his control, but one of the major problems with the opposition was that they weren't unified in their objections. Some opposed his religious ideology, some his politics, others his social reforms. The majority of the government backed Savonarola, and since the opposition did not have a unified voice, their criticism was quite ineffective. For some time, the overall impression we have had on the response of the artistic community to Savonarola's demands for simple, sacred creations is that they either knuckled under or moved out of town, as I've just pointed out. But this may not be entirely correct. There's a single work of art that has come to my attention recently that hints at a different kind of nuance in terms of opposition. A painter who expressed his objections to Savonarola's suppression of the secular arts. This is Filippino Lippi's painting, now in the National Museum of Berlin, usually referred to as Erato, an allegory of music. The title of the painting was not assigned by the painter, but there are a number of familiar symbols included in the work which have been cited by art historians over the last century as the reason for assigning the title. First of all, the major figure is Erato, the muse of music and dance. And then there's a stag, which is the symbol of the fleetness of sound. If we look closely at the stag's horns, we see they've been made into a lyre, which is the symbol of music and lyric poetry. Just below the lyre, two wind instruments, a set of panpipes, again, this symbol of music as played by the god Pan, and an instrument that looks like a type of recorder, again, associated with secular music making. But the principal scene doesn't seem to be about making music. The major focus is on the efforts of two cherubs who are in the process of tying a myrtle branch around the neck of a reluctant swan. So what is the artist getting at? The presence of the muse Erato, as well as so many of the other details in the painting, suggest that the meaning might be found among the ancient Greek myths, which were well known in Italy during the 15th century. Ovid's Metamorphosis was a favorite literary source of these tales among the Italian humanists and was published in Venice in 1497 in the vernacular. This becomes even more relevant when we see that from the inventory of Filippino Lippi's possessions at the time of his death in 1504, that a copy of Ovid's Metamorphosis was in his possession. In the Metamorphosis, Ovid does present several different tales that involve most of the characters found in the painting, although none of them, the tales, appear to be directly connected with the painting. The central figure, Erato, doesn't appear, but the lyre, panpipes, stag, and swan all can be found in various combinations within the tales. Pan is a central figure in the tale of King Midas, where with his panpipes, he challenges Apollo and his lyre to a performance duel. Then there's a story about Diana and a stag with human emotions that is torn to pieces by dogs. And another that tells of Cygnus, the ruler of Liguria, who abandons his kingdom and turns into a swan. But there is no mention of music or instruments in either of these tales. So we can see that the individual elements of the Lippi painting all can be connected to ancient myths, although a careful search through Ovid's works failed to uncover all of them in a single story. There's no doubt that Lippi intended the viewer to perceive the painting in terms of the ancient myths, but not to any particular one. If we take a close look at the musical instruments, a different story begins to emerge. We know that the painter was also a musician. At the time of his death, he possessed a lute, 5 recorders, and a book of secular songs. And the accuracy of his depictions of instruments in several of his other works indicates that he was quite familiar with the details of instrument construction, meaning, of course, that any variance from a technically correct representation is intentional. The instruments are depicted in such a way as to suggest both ancient and modern practices. The lyre, mounted on the head of a stag, of course, is pure fantasy in terms of practical performance. At the same time, it does resemble an ancient lyre sufficiently to allow the viewer to understand the image without any difficulty. It has 7 strings, a traditional number for this instrument, and a bone plectrum, which is the traditional tool for plucking a lyre. It's placed on the ground right at the foot of the instrument. But the artist has carefully arranged the strings of the lyre so that the first one on the left is separated from the others. And the 3rd string is longer than all of the others. This is not the string arrangement on an ancient lyre, where all strings are the same distance apart and all the same length. What the artist has done with this string arrangement is to suggest a lira da braccio, which was the contemporary replacement for the ancient lyre and served as the favorite humanist instrument for the accompaniment of lyric poetry. The lira da braccio at that time, as carefully and correctly depicted by Filippino Lippi in The Musicians, has the 1st string separated from the others so that it could be plucked. You see how it goes in from the side, it enters the peg box apart from the other instrument. And the 3rd string was the lowest sounding, which is the meaning of the extra length in the allegory painting. Also, the melodic string on the lira da braccio was the one on the right end. And in the allegory painting, that one is broken, which means that the instrument cannot be played. What Lippi has done is to combine attributes of both the ancient lyre and the contemporary lira da braccio, bringing to the painting a modern reference within the ancient context. The panpipes were still in use in Europe during the 15th century, unchanged from its ancient form, and therefore Lippi had no reason to alter it in order to establish both ancient and contemporary image, which continued to be a symbol of secular music and dance. It's portrayed accurately here with its traditional 7 pipes, but it's placed upside down on the ground beneath the lyre. The other wind instrument, however, is another of Lippi's hybrid ancient-contemporary concoctions. The instrument resembles a recorder in terms of its mouthpiece, length, and fingerhole arrangement. But Lippi has added details that relate it to the ancient aulos, a reed instrument with 2 straight pipes. He fitted the instrument with rings over 2 of the fingerholes, similar to those that were added to the ancient aulos in order to adjust its melodic mode. And you can see the instrument also has a flared bell on the end. The only woodwind instrument at that time with a flared bell was the pífaro, a reed instrument that was popular for the accompaniment of dancing. So again, Lippi has combined elements of an ancient instrument with those of 2 popular contemporary secular instruments. It's significant that none of the instruments are in the act of being played. An additional clue to the intended meaning of the painting is provided by the swan, which appears to be reacting to the efforts of the cherubs to tie the myrtle branch around its neck. According to tradition, the swan is mute except when it's dying. And at that point, it sings a beautiful song. That's, of course, where we get the reference to swan song for someone's final act. In this painting, there is no indication that the swan is about to die. And so we can assume that in spite of the facial gesture, it isn't making a noise. So we're left with the image of Arato, the muse of music and dance, presiding over a scene that includes explicit references to both ancient and contemporary musical instruments used in secular song and dance, but in a setting where no music is being performed. Nothing in the painting is making a sound. Neither Arato nor the cherubs have their mouths open in song. The wind instruments are silent, the lyre can't be played, and the swan is mute. The stag, instead of being the symbol of the fleetness of sound, is decapitated and therefore incapable of motion. In the central scene of the painting, the swan, usually a symbol of quiet tranquility, is strenuously and silently objecting to what's been forced on it, to the silencing of secular music as represented by broken and abandoned instruments. The painting, instead of being an allegory of music, is more accurately described as an allegory of silence, or music silenced. It would seem that Lippi's allegory painting was intended to be a political reaction to the suppression of secular music and the art, a silent and secret protest of the policies forced on citizens of Florence by Savonarola and his large radical following. In the painting, Lippi has brilliantly disguised both the political protest as well as the contemporary references by concealing them within what superficially appears to be the representation of classical myths. Given the sentiment in Florence when Savonarola held sway, neither a painting of contemporary scenes nor a dramatic protest of his policies would have been tolerated. But cleverly concealed in what at first glances appears to be another representation of classical myths, neither point would have been recognized for what it was. It's most likely that until Savonarola's death, the meaning of the painting would have been kept secret, just the quiet satisfaction of the artist who could bask privately in the knowledge that he'd made this silent protest. But after 1498, when conditions vis-a-vis the secular arts had returned to their former status, the secret could be shared without any fear of reprisals. And we can speculate that after that date, the symbolism of the allegory painting would have been relatively well known in Florence. But no documents have survived to transmit that information down through the centuries. The symbolism is so well disguised, its message was lost and has remained hidden for over 500 years. The discovery of this disguised protest opens the door to more questions about possible hidden protests from the artistic community. A few of the more secure humanists were vocal with their opposition almost from the beginning. As early as 1494, the humanist Marsilio Ficino wrote a letter to the cardinals claiming that Savonarola was the Antichrist. This theme was taken up by the artist Luca Signorelli, who painted a fresco that clearly depicts Savonarola as the Antichrist. You can see him center right in the Dominican habit, white with a black cowl. But that painting is not done in Florence. It was painted in the cathedral in Orvieto and not done until 1501, 3 years after Savonarola was dead. But what of other artists? Did Filippino Lippi stand alone, or are there other hidden protests yet to be discovered? We now have a single example of what to look for in the fine arts. But what about music? Could it be that some of the more enigmatic texts of sacred motets also contain a hidden message of protest? And what of the humanists, their essays and poetry? Is it possible that in addition to the few who spoke out, others hid their opposition within otherwise innocent-looking lines? Perhaps we should widen our search now to see if other members of the Florentine artistic community acted out in protest during the time of suppression. It would certainly change our current perception of how artistic community reacted to Savonarola. In any case, Filippino Lippi's Allegory of Music Suppressed stands as the first identified representative of an entirely new category of artistic expression, a painting with a hidden political message, whether it was a unique experiment or merely the tip of a yet undiscovered iceberg, remains to be seen.
So we have some time for questions for Professor McGee before we do what we always do and make a little set of tables and have a colloquy. So please feel free to ask questions, those of you who'd like to.
Yeah, I'm curious about the swan, because it's really difficult for me to see that as silent.
That's what?
Silent.
Well, the tales, and in fact, in the Metamorphoses, the swan does not make a sound until just the instant before death. And this is clearly not a death picture. And the swan in all other paintings that I know of is always portrayed as tranquility. And here's one that's not. That was what made me first begin to suspect it wasn't what it was, what it was suspected to be.
But if you looked at it, wouldn't you think of the sound that a swan makes rather than of Ovid's Metamorphoses?
Of course, if you lived in the 15th century, we'd know it doesn't make any sound until it dies. Yeah.
Just a factual question. Do we know anything about who this painting was? It was a commission or
no.
Where it was?
No. And the art historians have dated it only on stylistic grounds. They say it was from the last period of his life. He died in 1504, so I would guess that it was probably painted around 96, 97. Would have to have been before Savonarola was killed, if my interpretation is correct. I have trouble here. I have hearing aids, and they don't work very well.
Sorry, bad cold also. Since this is not, strictly speaking, a religious painting, how safe would it have been?
Oh, it's definitely not a religious painting. But since it was classical,
that
was the only other kind of painting that I found from that period that was allowed.
Oh, okay.
It was either sacred, I guess I should have said that in the lecture, that classical paintings were still allowed. But it was the contemporary things that were completely out.
So the painting, The Birth of Venus, must have occurred after his death, right?
I think it was
before
Savonarola.
How did it escape destruction?
I don't know where it was.
Well, it belonged to the Medici, so they may have taken it with them when they fled. And Botticelli himself actually became a convert to Savonarola and threw his own paintings on the model.
Yeah, that actually, I read that, and then an article I read about 2 months ago questioned that maybe he wasn't quite as subservient as had been stated. Someone questioned that it was the fact about throwing his paintings, his secular paintings on the fire, that was questioned, and it turns out to be a rather insecure reference.
I'd
read that.
His own painting changes absolutely dramatically afterwards.
Yes, certainly does.
I'm kind of curious about the motets and masses being sung 3 days after the arrest. Suggest either that the repertoire had been memorized and survived the disbanding of the choirs, or that somebody was burying some books around. Do you have any idea how much repertoire they were able to hide from the kids?
No. No idea. But they obviously all of the carnival songs from the time before Savonarola are all gone except that one piece. But we still have 8 really big collections, mostly of Netherlandish French chanson material from Florentine sources. They must have been hidden. Somebody knew enough to put those away, but you can imagine how many dozens of others didn't get hidden and were put on the bonfire. It must have been a terrible thing. Can you imagine burning all those things?
With all the properties people had outside of town, you know, with the I mean, you could imagine that it might be fairly easy for people of means to just secret away stuff so that the big bonfire of the vanities may not affect your, you know,
right.
your prized
yeah.
possessions at all. I don't know.
The problem would have been people of the working class
right.
squealing on him, telling Savonarola, because that was a big thing, was to have all the young people telling on their parents and on their neighbors. It was not a nice time in that way, anyway.
What is the branch that is being tied to the swamp?
Yeah, a myrtle branch. It was a symbol of fidelity. It's very often shown, and the muse is also wearing it in her hair. It would show up in symbols for weddings. This was, for a long time, this was thought to have been a wedding painting because of the myrtle, because it's faithfulness, devotion.
But the swan doesn't want to be faithful, and it's happened to have this tied to it.
Yes, he's not going to sit still for this at all. And that's unlike the swan. That's not the image you have of the tranquil swan who would be willing to do all of that.
Yeah. Swans mate for life, too, don't they?
From what I hear. I don't know if
they... they're reputed to. Yeah. So that would be an appropriate... Myrtle would be appropriate.
Yes, for this trick, yeah.
Are there other images? Go ahead, please.
I was just going to point out that, one of the strongest details supporting your argument seems to be the pan pipes upside down. That's really
yes.
quite striking,
yeah.
I think.
The other instrument, the recorder instrument, is also upside down. Let me see if I can find the detail. Where is it? Oh, yeah, there it is.
Yeah.
In the detail pane, you can see it a little better. I don't know if you can see that the strings on the lyre, get up close, you can see that the one on the right is broken. It's clearly broken. And the others, simply no relationship to the equal distance and equal length. He certainly knew what a lyre looked like. There are two other paintings where he paints lyres. And in all of them, the strings are equidistant and all the same length.
After his death, do we have accounts of festivals, and do we know, did they just go back to being what they were before, or was there any lasting effect of this period?
No lasting effect at all, from what I could tell. Yeah. It immediately reverted to the old system. Although there are lots of conversions all over to Savonarola's thinking. He was very popular in Paris for the next 50 years. All of his writings. And his writings were collected. So those people who were very religious held to the faith, but as a big popular movement, it was out. It was just for a very small number of the population.
Savonarola seems so out of sync with the landscape that you described, where the people of the community so much loved their secular as well as their sacred
yes.
art and culture. Can you comment a little more on how it is that he was able to get such a foothold in Florence, why he was became so influential?
Well, he started with a good principle. There was far too much immorality going on in town. I think everybody felt a little guilty. It wasn't the principles that he was proposing. It was the length that he went with them that finally got everybody back up. And then he finally became holier than everyone. You couldn't sacrifice enough. You couldn't pray enough. You couldn't burn enough of your secular things. And became insatiable. Everyone finally, I think, just got exhausted from it. But he himself remained true to his ideas. At one point, the Pope, before he excommunicated him, offered to make him a cardinal if he'd shut up. He turned it down. He said, no, I will remain a simple friar. So he really was convinced himself of what he was doing, although I'm sure that he was making up a lot of it. He said he was speaking to God. Now, I don't know how he would prove that.
So with the swan, I just think it's very interesting to contemplate the idea that the swan is actually squawking. Are there other images of swans from the era that show the swan with its tongue sticking out?
No.
I mean, I've never seen anything like that.
No.
Now, if indeed he's turning things upside down and distorting the right way of things, then perhaps an actual squawking swan is also a distortion of a reality that everybody knows is inherited from antiquity. And then that would be connected to the distortion of somehow an immoral forcing of fidelity? What is the theme? Are you saying that the swan is being forced to conform? Because I kind of like the idea that the swan is actually making noise as a violation of tradition in some way.
You want the full picture?
So we're talking about the swan.
Okay.
It just seems like that's such a dramatic. And so what is the myrtle branch representing? I forget what you said.
Fidelity.
To what, though?
Well, it's usually marital fidelity.
Right.
Which is why everyone thought this was a wedding picture.
Right.
But there's nothing else that would relate it to marriage. Mm-hmm. And a lot of things that would not. Especially since he's refusing the myrtle branch or objecting to it.
So what is this about then? What is this swan objecting to?
I think the swan is objecting to the silencing of secular music.
And what is Erato's role in that picture then?
The muse of dance, yes, has brought the swan, obviously, on that girdle, right?
Is she undoing the branch? I mean, because Erato is on the good side. I mean, Erato would not be a figure, a nefarious figure, right? So how is she helping?
No, you have me stumped there.
Yeah.
It also seems rather interesting that this one is really moving compared to the other three swans. So I was wondering if there is any...
That's what you usually see of swans. Mm-hmm. Yes. And every other painting that I could find from that era... You see the swans the way they are down on the left corner. Yeah, tranquil.
But the size is just, like, the change, the difference in scale is very significant.
Yes.
So I'm just wondering if that
No, I think that was just to make it prominent.
Okay.
I tried this out on the specialist. There's one art historian who's quite an authority on Filippino Lippi. A man by the name of Jonathan Katz. I tried my theory out and he said, oh, I always wondered about that painting. He wasn't very helpful. He didn't find anything to object to.
Yeah. Now, if this were Florence, is that an ocean or what's...
No, I don't think that... It's just a typical...
it's a scene. A
classical reference, the water in the back.
If there are not other questions for the moment, why don't we put our tables together and have a little conversation.